So as we continue with our exploration of the Samanya Pala Sutta, in the last few weeks we've discussed the Samadhi of the path and the description of the four dhammas. And we come to the what happens after jhanas. And remembering that this teaching is the gradual training. It's a very, very central teaching. It's a very important one. It's not just a kind of, you know, occasional one or just random thing. It's something that's taught again and again and again and again. And so we should remember that all of the things that we find here should be regarded as being quite central and quite important. Nevertheless, even though that's the case, in the description of what happens after jhanas, then we have these quite lengthy descriptions of these developing these various psychic powers. And these are something which are taught very often in Buddhism. There's various standard lists of them. And yet it's generally understood, and I think quite correctly, that the psychic powers as such are not essential to enlightenment. They're depicted as things which are perhaps useful and beneficial. Perhaps one of their main benefits is simply that they're quite exciting and they get people interested in meditating, because being able to walk on water is something that people can understand a lot better than realizing dependent origination, which might sound a little bit boring. So it has its various benefits, and yet most of the psychic powers are generally understood to be things that are not really essential, or they may be useful, but not necessarily essential for everybody. Now, in certain cases, these kinds of psychic abilities are felt to have arise spontaneously. So we all know that many stories of people have various psychic powers and so on who aren't even meditators, and these things just seem to arise for them. And typically this is explained by saying that they've practiced jhanas in their past life. And I remember when I did my first study of Buddhism in Wat Rampong in Thailand, and then they came to this bit, the teacher explained this point. And then he added, like Nostradamus. So, this is one explanation. And as well as that, we also find that people who meditate some people will experience various kinds of psychic powers, sometimes spontaneously. Whereas other people will have to develop them if they want to, they have to sort of consciously undertake a path of development. And as is not unusual in the suttas, that the suttas themselves don't give very much information on how to go about developing these things, and much of that background information is passed down through the oral tradition, as we find it in the Visuddhimagga, in the Theravada tradition, and various other places, and a lot of that information is still in the oral tradition, passed down through kind of local teachings in different monasteries according to the experience of different meditators. And so here we can just give an introduction to what the text is saying and and some of the traditional explanations of it. So at the beginning of the passage, so evam samahite chitte parisuddhe paryodate anangane vidupakilese mudubhute kamaniyeti ke anenjapate jnana dasanaya chittam abhinihaarati abhinnameti. And so with their mind thus in samadhi, yeah, the chitta, thus in samadhi. And notice the use of the word chitta in its very close connection with samadhi. It's very characteristic. Chitta. When it's talked about in a doctrinal sense, citta pertains to the Fourth Noble Truth and is often virtually a synonym for samadhi. Parisuddhe, purified. Pariyodate is from the word for white, so again purified or bright, something like that. Anangane, without blemishes. Vigatupa kilese, and here the word kilesa, obviously the word, normal word for defilement. Just as a note on language, that the word kilesa by itself is not actually used all that commonly in the Pali Suttas as a word. farmers. It's found that there's far more common words, asavas and various other things are more common. When kilesa does appear, it most commonly appears in this meaning, upakilesa, and where upakilesa means either just the five hindrances, or perhaps subtle, sometimes subtle manifestations of the five hindrances, which are an obstruction to development of deep samadhi. And as you can see here, it doesn't mean rid of all defilements in the sense of enlightenment, but merely refers to having overcome the defilements in the state of samadhi. Vigata, we is separated. Gata means come to a state of being separated from defilements. Mudu bhute, okay, having become mudu. And mudu means exactly what it sounds like. Mudu. Not muddy. Muddy is completely different. Muddy sounds muddy. Mudu is mudu. Mudu.
Like an owl.
Mudu, exactly like an owl. Gentle and soft and sweet like an owl. Mudu. So it might become mudu. Kama niye is workable. Yeah, kama, work. Niye is literally workable. And I was Rambajan Buddhadasa said this was the best description of the mind in samadhi, was that it was kamani, it was workable, fit for work. Pite. And I mean, and that's actually, that actually is a very important point, and it is very important to bear in mind that, that practicing samadhi doesn't render your mind incompetent. Right? And if you find yourself incompetent and not able to actually do things, then this is not samadhi. Yeah? But if you can't think, then well, obviously in the state of samadhi itself you can't think, right? But if you're talking about what happens afterwards, and if you become stupid, then this is not real samadhi. Having said which, sometimes it does. Yeah, sometimes if you have samadhi, then you do feel stupid and so on afterwards. But that's more just like as a passing thing when you especially when you're just developing it, but certainly not when it's mature. Chite is steady.
No, I don't think impressionable.
Well, fit for work is what it means. Kite, steady, anenjapate is attained to imperturbability, anenja. And the anenja is a technical term which is used to describe fourth jhana and the formless attainment, and refers to the imperturbable nature of the neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Mm-hmm. So this is the stock description of the mind having emerged from the fourth jhana. Okay, so with the mind in that way, jnana dasanaya, chittam, their mind is abhiniharati, abhininameti, is bent, and the mind is bent and inclined towards knowledge and vision, jnana dasana. Okay? So evam padjanati. They understand this. Okay, so here's the first of the actual knowledges that's mentioned here, and notice that this knowledge here is called jnana dasana. I'll come back to that in a minute. So evam padjanati. Understand thus, this, my body, is rupee. It's a rupee, it's worth 1 rupee, which is probably about the market price of it, but that's not actually what it means here. Rupee means it's, it possesses form, yeah? it's a material body, a physical body, as opposed to a divine body or something. Oh, even divine bodies can be a rupee, but in this sense it's physical or material, but also chatu mahabhutiko, made up of the four great elements. Chatu is four, great, maha, and bhuta. In this sense, bhuta is the four elements. Okay?
But
Something like that, except not quite. Actually, the word bhuta literally means what has been produced. So it's been produced, or like a conditioned thing. It's been produced from these four great conditions, conditioned things. Yeah. The notion of an element in Buddhism isn't like an ultimate building block to which everything else can be reduced. Yeah? But it says, as it is, it's a bhuta. It's something that has been produced in origination. Yeah, I mean, the reason for using it is not necessarily because the meaning of the word element isn't the same as the word bhuta, but because that theory of the earth, wind, water, fire is called elements in European alchemy and so on. Yeah, so. Mata tetika sambhavo, so produced from mother and father. Mother is the mata, father is the pita, here becomes the teti. Mata, obviously mother, and peta, or paternal, pita, sambho, produced from mother and father. O dana kumasu pachayo, upachaya means to heap up or build up something, so built up out of rice and bread. Rice and porridge, kumasu. So? Oh no, the super is an artifact of the one construction in actual. And then it's anichuchada parimadana bhedana vidhamsana dhammo, which of course you all know what that means. Moving along. No, seriously. You don't often find these long compounds in early Pali, but here's one which they start to get blurry in front of your eyes when you're looking at it. Anicca is impermanent. Uchadana. The next one is impermanent. Parimadana is like being massaged or rubbed. So I think uchadana is a similar meaning. Vedana is breaking up. Vidhamsana. I'm not quite sure what vidhamsana means. Dhammo. So usually translated something like rice and porridge is subject to inconstancy, rubbing, pressing, dissolution and dispersion. Okay. So, the typical translation. So, this is the nature of this body. And just to point out a linguistic usage here, notice the way that the word dhamma here is a suffix to this compound. And when dhamma is used as a suffix, it has a particular meaning. Of course, the word dhamma has many different meanings in different contexts. And here it means something like it has the nature of. Okay, and sometimes translated with the English idiom is subject to, which I don't like that rendering, to say something is subject to something, because that suggests to me that if something's subject to something, it means that there's something outside of it which is doing something to it, which is precisely not the point of this. The precise point of this is that's what it is. Yeah? It's not something's not that something's outside of it making the body break up, but it's the nature of the body to break up. So it's the nature rather than subject to.
That's
right, yeah. Yidancha paname vinyanam etta sitam etta papibadhante. And this, my consciousness, is caught up in it and bound up in that. Okay? Is supported here and bound up here. So this is a reflection on the interdependence and the relationship between consciousness and the body. Here, consciousness seems to be not necessarily the technical meaning of vijnana, but just meaning mind or awareness or something like that. as always in Buddhism, there's no kind of, Buddhism's not a dualistic philosophy, so Buddhism doesn't say that there's a kind of separate mind and body. In Western philosophy, if you're familiar with Western philosophy, you'll know that the mind and body problem, or mind and, or body and soul problem, is one of the greatest problems in Western philosophy, because you have this basic assumption, is the mind and the body are two separate things, two distinct entities. And this is already implied in the story of Genesis, yeah? Because in the story of Genesis you have the body, which is mud, and then God comes along and breathes breath into it. Yeah? I mean, that's not a philosophical statement, but it's suggestive, and it suggests that there's something which is a mind or a soul or something immaterial, which originally existed independently from the body and which somehow got injected into it at some stage, like you might sort of download some software into your computer, yeah? And this, of course, became a theme of the Platonic philosophers and the Socratic philosophers, and later on in Western philosophy was, of course, Descartes was very famous for this idea. And once you have this idea, then you're in big problems, because you then have to figure out how on earth can the mind and the body relate to each other. You know, what's the way of connecting them? And this is really a massive problem which Western philosophy has just struggled with for ages, and it struggled with it to such an extent, and it still has not even the slightest really attempt at resolution of it today. And the only main solution to it is simply to jettison the mind. And to talk about materialism, you know, that's the only actual cogent philosophical response to it, really, is materialism, which is just a monistic philosophy. It says all there is matter, and mind doesn't really exist. So this, for example, Richard Dawkins, is his philosophy. Or in psychology, we were discussing this yesterday, the behaviorists, and became so infuriated with this kind of problem of the mind and the body that they developed a whole system of psychology without the mind. Yeah? Bizarre, yeah? Completely bizarre. And even up until this day, there's still this incredible confusion about, you know, what is the brain and what is the mind, and, you know, the neuroscience is, you know, are we proving that, you know, in meditation, can you prove that somebody, we still have this kind of underlying thing, you know, somebody sits in meditation and they get peaceful and happy, right? Yeah? And then they put them in an MRI scan, and they show this incredibly complicated technology and these bright colours on a screen with a picture of their brain, and then you say, see, that proves that they're peaceful and happy. Yeah? No, it doesn't prove anything. All that proves is that you've got a machine that can make pretty pictures on a screen. The person knows that they're peaceful and happy. But this is, comes through this idea of this kind of that somehow we have such a problem with understanding the mind that we just can't get our heads around the idea that actually our primal experience is, of course, our mind. It's in fact the physical world which is problematic. It's the physical world which we have to infer, but our experience of the mind is straight there. In any case, as you can see from here, that the basic Buddhist contemplation is to look at the connection between these things and the relationship between them, and not to be imagining them as separate entities. And of course, this is exactly what our experience is, isn't it? Because we never experience a mind separate from the body, or a body separate from the mind, except perhaps in some occasional and exotic settings of out-of-body experiences or something like that. But leaving those aside, generally speaking, our experience is inextricably the entanglement and interrelationship. We see forms, and in that seeing there is a physical thing, the sight and the colour, there's a mental thing, the consciousness of it, there's a feeling, a reaction to it, and all of these things. And that's what our experience consists of. It doesn't consist of separate entities which we have to somehow combine. It consists of this matrix of interconnection and relationship, which we can, if we want to, then tease out different aspects of it for the purpose of understanding it and clarifying how it works. But we're not presented with these two separate things. Okay, so this is this first contemplation, the contemplation of the mind and the body. And with all of these, as in normal in the Samanyapala Sutta, represented with a very beautiful simile, which I'll just read out in the English translation from the Victoria here. Great King, suppose a man were to draw... Oh, wrong one. Great King, suppose there were a beautiful beryl gem. The word for beryl is velurio, the same root, of purest water, eight-faceted, well-cut, suparikamakato, well-cut, well-worked. Notice the use of the word kama here. Well worked, relating to the kama in the fourth jhana. Well cut, clear, limpid, flawless, endowed with all excellent qualities. And through it there would run a blue, yellow, white, or red, or brown thread. A man with keen sight, taking it in his hand, would reflect upon it thus. This is a beautiful beryl gem of purest water, eight faceted, well cut, clear, limpid, flawless, endowed with all excellent qualities, and running through it there is this blue, yellow, red, white, or brown thread. In the same way, Great King, when his mind is thus concentrated, pure and bright, the bhikkhu inclines and directs it to knowledge and vision, and understands that this is my body, having material form, composed of the four primary elements, originating from mother and father, built up out of rice and gruel, impermanent, subject to rubbing and pressing, to dissolution and dispersion, and this is my consciousness, supported by it and bound up with it. So, a beautiful simile, and just to notice that something which is perhaps not pointed out or not raised to awareness as often as it should be, that in Buddhism we often hear these teachings, the body is ugly and it's asubha and it's foul and disgusting and all of these kinds of things. Well, here's the Buddha giving a simile where the body is compared to a bright and radiant pure jewel, you know, of the clearest colour and brightness. So just to notice that these things are not absolutes. And this is a perception which arises in meditation. And if you've done, for example, if you do the metta meditation and you learn to soak the rapture and bliss through your body, then you do indeed get this idea. The body becomes radiant and you feel light. And body is sitting there like a glowing gem or a glowing crystal. And so this is... Not a random image by any means. So this is the kind of image, this is the way that somebody who's had fourth jhana, that's how they see the body. Now, yeah. Yeah, that's right, yeah. So they're consciousness, and also more importantly, the simile, of course, is of a necklace or something, where you have a string with a series of gems, right? And the series of gems, of course, are the series of bodies in different lives, and the consciousness being the thread which ties all those different lives together. Yeah. I don't know, maybe just makes it more vivid. Yeah. It brings it to life again. Mm. And we'll also notice the clarity of the metaphor, and as we find with all of these, this observation, it's something which is so clear, yeah, and presented in such straightforward terms. You have good eyes, you just pick it up, you look at it in your hand, oh, that's what it is. So that's the clarity of the insight and the contemplation that we're talking about here. So this is why, of course, it's always that after the jhanas, and especially after the fourth jhana, that the contemplation becomes so deep and so clear that there's no distraction and so on. And one of the interesting things about this particular knowledge, now notice Tanisha's translation here. It says insight knowledge, right? And if you come back here to the text, which I've copied it out from, this is the Burmese text in the Royal Tripitaka Society. Notice here it says vipassana jnana, which Tanisha has translated insight knowledge. Of course, that's not part of the text, right? That's a heading which an editor has put into it, right? And there's no mention of vipassana in the sutta itself. And there's no mention of the term vipassana jnana anywhere in the Pali Canon, right? But the Burmese editors of this text were proponents of the Mahasi Vipassana school, and so they no doubt felt it expedient to clarify that vipassana jnana does actually happen in the suttas. This particular knowledge, let me just give some from the commentary. This, most of these psychic powers, or higher knowledges, just as a comment, first of all, an important comment, is that these are called the artha jnana, you see the term here? And the eight knowledges, also known as abhinya, higher knowledges or direct knowledges, and so it's always regarded as some kind of higher way of seeing or higher way of knowing. Now some of these, like this one, of course is very easy to understand as a higher way of knowing. We're talking here about an insight into the nature of our reality. That's not a problem. Other ones we'll see later, you know, like walking on water and these various kinds of psychic powers. It's less clear why these are in fact called knowledges, yeah? But they're always classified as a knowledge. And of course we're now talking about the wisdom section of the path. What's emerged after samadhi, this is the wisdom section of the path. And what's quite striking is that this description of the wisdom section of the path is quite different from the what's presented in the series of vipassana jnanas and the insight knowledges as presented in the Visuddhimagga, and as is accepted within the mainstream Theravadin school. Some of them are similar, like this one, other ones are quite different. So this is something which is worth bearing in mind. So I'll just go through some of the description now of the... sorry, I should have mentioned that the most of these knowledges are described in detail in the Visuddhimagga. But the Visuddhimagga essentially describes what we call the Chalabhinya, the six direct knowledges, okay, or six higher knowledges. And Samanyapala Sutta, because it gives a very full presentation, includes another two before talking about those Chalabhinya. So this one, the knowledge of the interdependence of mind and body, and then the second one is the knowledge of the creation of a mind-made body. And these are not normally included in the six Abhinya, the six higher knowledges, but only in the extended presentations do we find these. So these are obviously somehow, again, it's quite curious because it would seem to us, it would seem intuitively that this particular one is actually one of the most important ones, and yet actually is one of the ones which is least often actually taught. And as such, it's not found in the Visuddhimagga, and the detailed commentary is found in the commentary to the Samanyapala Sutta itself. So I'll just read through some of that.
What's the difference between an arahant and a enlightened
person? Yep. Different, one's cooler than the other. Oh, you have psychic powers, it's much cooler. Yeah. But the other one doesn't care. He's different. He knows that the other guy's cool, but he doesn't care.
But the
I don't know. It's a bit. In a sense, it's just that different people have different strengths and weaknesses. You know, so what Arahants have in common is the ending of defilements. That's what they have in common. As far as other qualities, some may be more intelligent than others, some may be more, you know, socially adept than others, some may be more whatever. But they're still a different quality. Look, it may be the case, I don't know, and this is apparently controversy in the tradition, whether it's possible for an Arahant to actually learn them after they become an Arahant. I wouldn't see why not, but you know, maybe, you know, an Arahant learned how to play tennis, well, presumably, so why shouldn't they be able to learn how to read minds or whatever, but you know, maybe they're not interested in it.
Also, if you're Arahant, then you can do all this stuff, right?
Yeah.
Oh,
you get to see the view, it's nice, you can feel the difference, you know, the monkeys playing in the forest, and everything would have been nice.
Well,
yeah, you can't just get something enlightened, that's not what I want.
Yes, but if you can read their mind, you know exactly where they're defiling. So you just have pointers to them.
Well, yeah, I mean, presumably that's what he did, yeah? I mean, the Buddha's obviously renowned for his skill in teaching, and there's many occasions where that's no doubt exactly what he did. But you can't, you know, you can't save anybody else, and the Buddha's very clear about that. I can't myself save anybody, it's you yourself that has made the effort. So people are not ready for it, there's nothing you can do.
I think if one sees the Tao, there's some good for him. Without putting the belief in it, becoming some good.
And then there's some Lutheran paragraph. Somebody asked the Buddha about what's the difference between art and that the theories of art are listed. And then someone else really talked all this stuff. And then the Buddha gave the simile of, do you understand, you know, if someone who understands something, if they really understand the three Dhamma theory,
I'm saying they didn't have the psychic powers. And forms of hands. So they had the knowledge and understanding of Dhamma.
The psychic power, you can reach the fourth Dhamma and get
yourself. Yeah. That's right, but they still really didn't have it. Not everybody who has fourth Dhamma has psychic power. Yeah. I don't understand what you don't understand. Like there are certain the development of the path. There are certain qualities which some people will realize and some won't. I don't see what the problem is. Some monks will practice and they'll know how to speak Thai, and some will know how to speak Pali, and some won't. I don't see what the issue is.
I didn't understand Buddha's answer.
Mm-hmm.
When he gave the simile that when you ask that person back and say, "Do you understand and return your authority?"
Yeah.
So I don't understand the answer.
said that they didn't have any to farmers. And then, are you talking about sustainers with them? The last Asima, I went to Ananda, I went asked for ordination, and Ananda gave him the going forth, and then at a large number of monks. Now, some of the versions of this story, he was. Oh no, here we go, in this version of the story, yeah. Right. Okay, so Buddha was wealthy and famous, and so the other wanderers said, okay, let's go and learn the Dhamma from Gotama, and when we've learned that, we can teach it to householders, and then we too can be worshipped and get lots of robes and stuff. So Sathima said, no problems, what a great idea. He went off, ordained, and got ordination. So then a large number of monks had declared final gnosis. Gnosis is anya, is arahantship. We discern that birth is ended, the holy life fulfilled, the task done, there is nothing further for the sake of this world. Okay, so large number of monks have declared that they're arahants. Sathima went to see them, said, g'day. And then he sat down to one side. He said, is it this true? They said, yes. And then they said, having known thus, do you wield supernormal powers, having one become many, and so on, having many become one, and so on, which is all what we're going to be talking about in a minute. No, friend. They don't have those powers. Then, having known thus, do you have the divine ear? No, friend. Then do you not, do you read the minds of other beings? No. Do you recollect your past lives? No. It's all been the chalabhinya. Then do you see being born and reborn according to their power, according to their karma? No. It's the divine eye. Having known thus, do you dwell touching with your body the formless jhanas? Of course, it's being an overly literal rendering here, which you can't have a body in the form of jhanas by definition. So what the idiom here, the word kaya means personally. So person, you personally experience or personally witness those peaceful emancipation, formless attainments. So they say no, and then they say, didn't you make that declaration without having attained any of these dhammas? And then they said, we are released through wisdom, through panya. And Sathima, like Sada, says, I don't understand what you mean. It would be good if you would say, if you explain it, so I would understand it. And then they said, whether you or not you understand, still be a release through discernment. So then he went to the Buddha and told him, and the Buddha said, first, Sathima, there is the knowledge of the regularity of Dhamma, after which there is the knowledge of Nibbana. Which, where are we now? Ube ko susima dhamma piti jnana vacha nibbane jnana ti. Okay, so this is a slightly obscure little phrase there. I'll come back to it in a minute. And Sathima again says, I don't understand the detailed meaning of the Blessed One's brief statement. And then he says, whether or not you understand, Sathima, it is still the case that first there is the knowledge of the regularity of the Dhamma, after which there is the knowledge of Nibbana. So, what actually the statement means is actually not as obscure as all that. It's just one of these things where the phrasing is a bit difficult to capture. But what Dhamma Piti Jnana means is, Dhamma is of course the Dhamma, jnana is the knowledge, and piti is the regularity, or the fact that things happen in a regular pattern. And dhammapiti jnana is a word that's used mainly to describe dependent origination. So dhammapiti, in other words, that things happen according to predictable and constant patterns. Things tend to happen in certain ways. Some of the same things keep on happening, but they happen in certain ways. Yeah. So just to give you an example, you say that the climate has a certain pattern to it. Yeah. We have the summer and the winter and so on. Even though the summer is never the same, the winter is never the same, and yet there is that kind of, we can expect from one year to the next that there will be that pattern. And so this is that sense in which there's a regularity to the dhammapiti, which is dependent origination. So, first of all, you have an insight into this principle of dependent origination, and then afterwards you have the knowledge of nibbana. In other words, that the realization of nibbana happens dependent on the insight into dependent origination. Hey, if it's not clear, say it for them.
Well, this answer, yeah, talking about, first of all, you have to see the dependent origination, and then you kind of penetrate the point.
Yeah.
How does that relate to what Susino's question about
dependence? Well, he's obviously saying you don't need psychic power. You realize nibbana because you're understanding the dependent origination. Yeah, something like that. Mm. Yeah, exactly. That's a good simile, actually, because some people might not eat the cake if it didn't have any cream. Mm. Yeah? So if it looks like a really boring piece of cake, they'd go, oh, I've got a little bit of that. Yeah. But if it looks cool, it's got lots of cream on it, I'll have a slice. Yeah? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah? And then he goes on to teach more about not self and so on. And eventually, what happens to him? Eventually, teaches dependent origination and not self and so on. And then he comes back to the topic of the psychic powers. And then Susima confesses his fault and then starts practicing properly. Okay. So to come back to the knowledge of the jnana dasa. Okay, so here's the commentary on that passage. So talking about the body, which is impermanent, subject to rubbing and dispersion and so on. It says it's impermanent in the sense of not being after having been. It is subject to rubbing because it is anointed with perfume, etc., in order to remove its bad smell. It is subject to pressing because it is massaged to dispel ailments of the limbs. Also, when children have limbs that have been misshapen during their stay in the womb, during infancy they are made to lie between the thighs and are pulled and pushed in order that their limbs may acquire the proper shape. Interesting little insight into some child-rearing practices there. It is subject to dissolution and dispersion because, though maintained in such ways, it is its very nature to break up and be scattered. Okay, so that's basically just talking about impermanence. Okay, so this, they're talking about the consciousness supported by and bound up with the body, composed of the four primary elements. This is said according to the new sub-commentary. This is said because the insight consciousness, vipassana citta, is supported by the heart basis included in the body. Okay, so notice how the commentary works here. The sutra itself just talks about the body, and we've now shifted to talking about the heart basis, the Hareya Vattu, which according to the commentary is where consciousness is actually based. For it is only this insight consciousness when occurring that is known directly by direct cognition, thus this is my consciousness. Okay, so the point here is that our ordinary mind is not directly aware of itself, but only the insight consciousness is aware of consciousness itself. It is bound up with the body because it does not occur without the body, and because it takes as its object the material phenomena designated the body. The application, and coming back to the basic commentary, the application of the simile of the gem should be understood as follows. The gem is like the material body, and the thread running through it is like insight knowledge, insight consciousness. Okay, the man with the keen sight is like a bhikkhu who gains insight. The time when the man takes the gem in his hand, reviews it, and clearly knows this is a gem is like the time when the bhikkhu is sitting, having directed his mind to insight knowledge, and the body composed of the four primary elements becomes clear to him. The time when it becomes clear to the man, this is a thread running through it, this is like the time when the bhikkhu is sitting, having directed his mind to insight knowledge, and it becomes clear to him that the pentad inclusive of contact, or all states of consciousness and mental factors, or insight knowledge alone, take that as their object. It's getting a bit technical, but the pentad inclusive of contact is the tassa pancha maka, which is consciousness, feeling, perception, volition, and contact. Okay, so this insight knowledge immediately precedes the path. Okay? So this is kind of interesting, showing how they're kind of negotiating the different conceptions of the path and the development of insight. This insight knowledge immediately precedes the path, but even so, it is shown here, for there would be no intermediate place for it once the section on the direct knowledges has begun. In other words, what they want to say is that it's actually this knowledge, which is the knowledge which immediately precedes enlightenment, right? However, there's a bit of a problem because it's right here at the beginning of the jnanas and not at the end. Yeah? So why is that? So it's saying, well, there's no place for it afterwards. Which, not necessarily that persuasive an argument, but anyway. It is also shown here in order to help one who has attained direct knowledge acquire the means for dispelling fear. Which is an interesting little perspective. For when one hears a fearful sound with the divine ear, or recollects fearful aggregates with the recollection of past lives, or sees a fearful form with the divine eye, fear and terror arise if one has not explored formation. Sankharas as impermanent, etc., but they do not arise if one has explored sankharas as impermanent, etc. So, this is kind of an interesting thing. And then the new sub-commentary then takes it up. So it's like the tradition is not comfortable with this at all, right? So they're taking it up and giving a series of explanations. Why is this particular knowledge here at the beginning? And then the new sub-commentary then comments on the commentary. The criticism might be raised that since insight knowledge immediately precedes the path, it should be mentioned after the mundane kinds of direct knowledge, but before the sixth direct knowledge, insight into the ending of defilements. Then why is it mentioned prior to all the direct knowledges? And it then goes on to explain why that is there. The explanation for the commentaries claimed that there would be no intermediate place for it. The new sub-commentary says, what that means is that after the five mundane direct knowledges have been explained, the sixth direct knowledge, ending of defilements, must then be explained as is done in innumerable suttas, for it has the characteristic of direct knowledge and is thus included in that category. But insight knowledge cannot be explained by inserting it between the mundane kinds of direct knowledge and the sixth direct knowledge, for it lacks the characteristic of direct knowledge and is thus not included in that category. Thus, there is no place for insight knowledge in between the direct knowledges. Well, you can find that persuasive if you choose to. A little bit tenuous to me, but anyway. So this is the description of that anyway. Well, no, because the because then why is the why is it not included in the Chalabinyan 6-0 commentaries? It's these two, the first ones that we're looking at, are not they're the first two of the eight knowledges in the Samanipala Sutta. So they're taught in the Digha Nikaya, but in dozens and dozens of other places they're not there at all. Why does that matter? Well, it's presumably you put the important things in the main. They're the things you don't drop out. Yeah, you can drop off the CD player and the leather seats, but you keep the engine. I don't have a particular answer for this, but it's just sort of raising it as just as an interesting point as to why this knowledge actually is somehow seemingly less central than one might expect it to be. It's a curiosity. I don't have a reason for it.
It's just been calling it inside knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well that's not necessarily a straightforward question, but just to make it clear, here's just the list of titles, okay, from the Pali. So this is just a section title. So the first one, so these are the eight knowledges. Of these eight knowledges, the last six are the Chalabinya, the six direct knowledges, which are taught very, very often. And of those six, the last three are the Tevija. Okay? And that group of eight is typically only found in the Digha Nikaya. And these first two, the knowledge and vision and mind made body, are found much less often. They might be found occasionally in other contexts as well, but it's not a part of this listing in the same way. So then the question is, how do these actually relate to the Vipassana Jnanas? So the Vipassana Jnanas as an explanation technique was first developed in the Patisambhita Magga, which is probably one of the latest books in the Pali Canon, 400 years after the Buddha, and then developed much further and explained in much more detail in the Visuddhimagga, and from there formed the basis of the modern Vipassana schools. There's no particularly clear correlation between the two. There's no correlation. The only meaningful correlation really is the start of the first of the Vipassana Jnanas is the Namarupa Paricheda Jnana, the knowledge of the separation between mind and body, the distinction between mind and body, which is related to this one. The Siddhimagga equates the two. And then, of course, the last one is the destruction of the defilements, but in between. Okay. So vision of body anadasana. Okay, next one. The mind made body. And so then, sorry, I should say, then it finishes up. This great king is another fruit of the holy life, which is more sublime and more profound than those which have come before. And it goes on to the mind-made body, and again repeats with each of these phrases, repeats the each of these knowledges, repeats the passage on the fourth jhana and the purity of the mind from fourth jhana. But this time it says one bends and inclines one's mind that to mano mayam kayam. Okay? Mano mayam kayam. So the mano is the mind, mayam is made, kaya is the body. And so this term mano maya kaya is frequently used. It's basically the same as what we say in English, the astral body or the subtle body or something like that. And it's normally used for certain of the heavenly realms. The beings in certain of the heavenly realms are said to have mind-made body. And here is meditative practice for projecting the mind-made body from this body. So imam ha kaya, from this body, anyam kayam, another body, abhiminati, one produces another body from this body, which is form, rupi. And notice the two descriptions of the body, that the previous one, when it's talking about the physical body, it says this body is rupi, and then chatu mahabhutiko mahapetika sambhavo. Here is rupi manomaya, made of mind, sabbanga pachangang, complete with all of its limbs. Okay, so this is an important point with the mind-made body. The mind-made body is not a kind of a ball of light or something like that. Yeah, it's actually a body with limbs. Yeah, it's very, very clear that they actually have arms and legs. Right? All the parts of their ahin indriyam, meaning it's complete with all its faculties, so all of the senses are working in that mind-made body, yeah? So the mind-made body can see and hear and so on. There's now two bodies, yeah. So who's doing the hearing, hearing and seeing and stuff? It starts to become quite complicated.
One can just
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. One monk, Meditula Bantaka, he made many, many bodies, and they were doing work and, you know, they were interacting in the physical world.
Yeah, how literally we're meant to take that story, I'm not sure, but I don't know, I don't know. Yeah, how are mind-made bodies, what degree they interact. I mean, it's still rupee, you know, so it's not something immaterial. So it's like an energy body or something like that. I mean, the idea of an astral body picking up a spade and digging the ground.
Well,
I think the stimulus is very interesting.
Uh-huh.
Because the way that people are sort of thinking about
there's
the actual physical human body. The stimulus always always refers to this like shell,
So
you have a sort of fairly
But just to have a look at the simile here, this great king just like a a man were to draw out a reed from its sheath. You would think this is the reed, this is the sheath. The reed is one thing, the sheath another. But the reed has been drawn out from the sheath. Or suppose a man were to draw a sword from its scabbard. He would think this is the sword, this is the scabbard. The sword is one thing, the scabbard another thing, but the sword has been pulled out from the scabbard. Or suppose a man were to pull out a snake from its slot. Is it slot? Slot? Slough? Slough? Sloth. Sloth, is it? As in enough? Sloth and slough. If it was enough, it would be slough. But that would just be too silly for words. Sloth. Sloth, is it? Okay, I'll say sloth. He would think, this is the snake, this is the sloth. The snake is one thing, the sloth another, but the snake has been pulled out from the sloth. In the same way, Great King, when the bhikkhu is just concentrated, clean and bright, the bhikkhu directs and inclines it towards creating a mind-made body. And this body creates another body, having material form mind-made, complete in all its parts, not lacking any faculties. This too, Great King, is the visible fruit of the Kluship, more excellent and sublime than the previous one. Well, it's still alive, you don't die. To what extent it's still functioning is not clear again. I mean, it could be, from what it says here, it could be that you know, you're simply just still in meditation, and the astral body goes off and has its adventures and stuff. And then you're saying, yeah, that's the feeling.
Mind made body and mind of the brain.
Why? Why is it mad? What's a mad people who's like his heart?
I thought
we depends what world you're talking about. In the world of the suttas, the psychic powers are always said to be dependent on fourth jhana. But in the real world, it doesn't seem to be the case. Certainly in the Indian tradition generally, that's not the case. But I think what the point is that here, that you see the description of these psychic powers, they're always kind of very clear and very cool and very kind of rational, you know. It's just something you pick up and you see and you want to fit, you know. So I think to have that, to have to really develop it, if you have the fourth jhana and then you have the equanimity and the power of mind from that, then that's how the psychic power is. It's just very clear and it's very straightforward. Whereas, you know, people who maybe get them from other means, and again, whether you can or not, I don't know, then maybe not so balanced about it. The sutras don't exclude the possibility of people having psychic powers from other means. They simply say that after the fourth jhana that one can develop them, but they don't have a stance on whether it's possible to develop it in other ways. In fact, there are places where it suggests that it is possible to develop in other ways. For example, there's a passage in the Vegan Nikaya where it's talking about the disadvantages of psychic powers, and it says that somebody could reproduce them by doing these magic charms and mantras. Yeah, something in the Vega.
The one about the most
great
fucking
pair. Maybe Kevin
Sutra wasn't it. Accumulating the structure of the great pair.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
That can't be placed.
Yes, that's right, yeah. So the other ones can be back. Okay, so here we have the commentarial discussion, some excerpts from the commentarial discussion of this. And remembering, of course, this is the commentary on the Samanyatala Sutta itself. It says, if the possessor of supernormal power is white, then the form he creates will also be white. If his earlobes are unpierced, the form will also have earlobes which are unpierced. Okay? So that's a bit of a problem, isn't it? If you wanted to have pierced ears without the pain, then you rip off. Okay. Oh, this is cute. Not lacking any faculties. the new sub-commentary comments on a passage in the commentary which says, not deprived of any faculties by way of figure, santana, what does that mean? It is complete by the way of the figures of the eyes, ears, etc. So it has the physical shape of the eyes, ears, and so on. For the created form has no sensitivity to sense objects. Huh. So the new sub-commentary is saying that the mind, may, body can in fact see and hear things, which I think is exactly what the sutra is not saying. The statement shows that there is also no life faculty, etc., in the created form. Again, it's a kind of bizarre statement. The sutra clearly says ahin indriyam without not lacking any faculties. Huh. So according to the new sub-commentary anyway, the creative form has the appearance of eyes and ears and so on, but can't actually see and hear. But yeah, I mean, it depends which one you take it. If it's the skin that's behind, it's the body that's left behind. Right. So if you leave the real one behind, the real one doesn't have it, can't see and hear and so on. But the one that's been, which has been drawn out from it, the one which is drawn out is the mind made body. Yeah. So, I mean, to me that would make sense, that if you have an astral body, you're sitting in meditation and the body which remains behind is, you know, it's just sitting in samadhi, so it's not sitting and hearing and stuff, you know, but it's the mind, the body which is projected out. And that seems to be what people's description, isn't it, of these kinds of things, to have out-of-body experiences, that they see things from the point of view of what has left the body, and then that's what the experience is. Yeah. That's why it's an out-of-body experience. yep. Yeah. Well, they're not using a chatu mahabhutika mata petika sambhava. I? Yeah? What I think is, I mean, it doesn't actually explain it, but what I think is that actually our bodies always have an energy field which is associated with them. And that energy field, of course, is produced by physical stuff, yeah, which is working, always working together with life and with the mind and stuff, but it has a distinct energy pattern which you can, maybe is what you capture when you're doing aura photography or something like that. And normally, you know, when you have that energy field, that is sort of very intimately and very immediately dependent on the physical body to sustain it, right? But in certain circumstances, like for somebody who's developed samadhi and they've developed a really strong consciousness, then it's possible to separate them. They're still dependent because that energy body is still dependent on the previous development of meditation, which is development dependent on the physical body. It's not independent of the physical body. It's merely separate for a period of time. But it can't sustain that indefinitely. It's like it's got to build up its momentum. It's like it's a ball tossed in the air. It can fly for a while, but it's dependent on the energy which was given beforehand. So this is my way of understanding it, is that you energize your mind and your body to such an extent through the practice of samadhi that allows that energy pattern to hold itself together for a period of time. And that doesn't prove anything, but it's just a way of making sense of it. It's like if you switch off the power in a electrical appliance, you know, it still lasts for, the power stays in there for a second or two because the magnetic fields are collapsing. So the energy sustained, even though the source of power has gone off, the energy sustains for a period. Yeah, right, really. that mind-mind body here. This is the mind made body, and then it goes on to the I should say that the most important thing to say about this whole mind made body thing is that the mind made body obviously is a prime candidate for a soul, right? So if you're having meditative experience, some other kind of experience, that's what people think, isn't it? My soul left my body, yeah? This is myself, my real self is out there. My real self is this spiritual energy astral thingy, which floats and flies and does all this cool stuff, right? And I've left this other thing behind. So obviously if you're a self theorist and you're inclined to think about things in terms of a self, then this would be a prime thing, and you do indeed find this in the Brahmanical scriptures, in the Upanishads. The mind-made body is one of the things which is claimed to be the self. And so here, so this practice is essentially a practice of not self, yeah? So it's a practice of seeing that this mind-made body, which I've lost now, mind-made body is dependent. So like with always with Buddhism, that you always investigate things. So the Buddha didn't want you to just say, no, this mind-made body isn't a self, but wanted to actually investigate and inquire to it. So when you experience it and when you see the transience of this, you see the fact that it's dependent on the development of meditation and so on, and particularly when you see the thing, the point that it's made of mind. Yeah? And so you know that it can't be anything which is a self or a soul, it's not something which is pre-existing or which is my inherent essence or eternal being or anything like that. It's something which is produced because I've developed my mind in a certain way. Yeah? And so this sort of undercuts that tendency to claim that it's in itself.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, that would be precisely the difference. So Ayonisa Manisikara would be, you have this experience and then you think, oh, this must be myself. This is going to be eternal. And it's Ayoniso because it's not looking at causes. It's assuming that there's this self, and it's not looking at the reality of it. The reality is that it's a temporary experience. Yeah. Well, the mind leaves the body for a while, has certain experiences, and then comes back. Yeah, whereas Yonisa Manasikara is to look at it as it is. And then, you know, it gives these lovely, because this is where it has these lovely similes in the Upanishads, like the bird which flies out of your mouth, like your soul is a bird, flies out of your mouth and flies around when you dream and has all of these adventures. And then, so you can't wake up somebody when they're dreaming, because the soul might not be able to find its way back into your mouth. That, yeah, that's a bit of a worry, isn't it?
That's what they say about Bodhidharma. They don't like the fact that he's not
entering.
He's supposed to be entering.
Yeah.
So they said that when he was in jail, that
somehow
came along with all the body.
One wants to say one of the most dangerous was that type of upset in the prison. But I don't like the front of the phone, thank you.
Why, related to what? Exactly.
There was something about meeting the travel of the concentration of love and the mind related to the form of free relation.
That's possible. There's some theories of asthma and so on that say you're reason you get asthma is because you've got too much oxygen in your blood. I've done that. I haven't duct taped my mouth after I'm asleep, but I get very bad hay fever sometimes. And it's actually very true. If you just don't breathe, the hay fever just goes away. But you have to go through the death panic stage first. Yeah. Just a little tip for anybody, if you've got really bad hay fever, just hold your breath until you think you're going to die. And quite amazing. Has anyone done it?
Yeah. How long
did you do? I don't know. You try not to hold it for long, so you just try to breathe out as much as possible, and then don't breathe in. After a while, you just hit this panic stage, and this kind of panic comes up. And when the panic comes up, just all of the phlegm, everything just disappears. You just go boom.
Yeah,
I don't know. Yeah? Okay. No, multi. Don't do it in a swimming pool. Right? Okay, so we've got about half an hour left in this thing. So what I might do, we're now going on to the discussion of the Chal Abhinya, right? So these six. And obviously you won't get through all of those now, but I might just give some of the preliminary description of that it gives in the Visuddhimagga for the development of these various kinds of supernormal powers. Now, it starts out here talking, we've just been talking about samadhi and the development of concentration and the benefits of concentration. Okay, so then it talks about how to do this. If a meditator wants to begin performing the transformation by supernormal power, he must achieve the eight attainments. Okay, so it's the four jhanas and four formless jhanas. Again, this is according to the Visuddhimagga, so it's obviously quite different to how the suttas present it. But he must achieve the eight attainments in each of the eight kasinas, ending with the white kasina. So the eight kasinas, of course, being the four colors and the four elements. So you have to do each of the eight jhanas, and you have to do them based on each of the eight kasinas. He must also have complete control of his mind in the following 14 ways, and then goes on to give them. First of all, the order in the sequence of the kasinas. That means that you first attain jhana in the earth kasina, after that in the water kasina, and so on, progressing through the eight kasinas, even doing that 100 or 1,000 times. And then you can do that in reverse order as well. And then forward and reverse order. You can attain again and again from the first jhana up to the base consisting of neither perception nor non-perception in the order of the jhanas, and then attain it again in the reverse order, and then the order and reverse order. Then you can skip alternate jhanas without skipping the kasinas. So that means you get the first jhana based on the earth kasina. Following that, you skip up to the third jhana based on the earth kasina, and then remove the kasina and get to the base of infinite space, and then the base consisting of nothingness. This is called skipping jhanas. And then you do the same thing based on the water kasina, and so on. Or you can skip kasinas without skipping jhanas. So you first of all get the earth kasina, and then get the fire kasina, and so on. But then you skip both jhanas and kasinas. So you get the first jhana based on the earth kasina, and then the third jhana based on the fire kasina, and so on and so forth. So this is attaining the first. Then you have the transposition of factors, attaining the first jhana of the earth kasina, and then the others in that same kasina, and then the transposition of objects, attaining first jhana of the earth kasina and that same jhana in the water kasina, and so on. It talks about more detail about that. Then you define the factors through defining the having like a clear awareness, a clear understanding of the different factors in the different jhanas, the presence of vitaka, vichara, and so on. And you define the object. Okay, and then so this is kind of practicing mastery of samadhi. It's obviously, again, nothing like that is ever taught in the suttas. How relevant it is, I have no idea, but it's one of the bases in the Pa'ok system that they teach the meditators to master the jhanas in that kind of way, sort of skipping up and down through them and alternating them and so on. So if you're interested in that, then go and do a Pa'ok retreat and learn to skip your jhanas. And again, according to the Visuddhimagga, more important bit here, it is not possible for a meditator to begin to accomplish transformation by supernormal power unless he has previously completed his development by controlling his mind in these 14 ways. Now, the kasina preliminary work is difficult for a beginner, and only 1 in 100 or 1,000 can do it. The arousing of the nimitta is difficult, and only 1 in 100 or 1,000 can do it. Extending the nimitta is also difficult. Only 1 in 100 or 1,000 can do it. Reaching absorption is difficult. Training your mind in absorption is difficult. And so on. And only 1 in 100 or 1,000 can do it. Rapid response after attaining transformation is difficult. And only 1 in 100 or 1,000 can do it. So here it's emphasizing how you might as well give up before you start. Now, like the Venerable Rakita, who, 8 years after his full admission to the order, was in the midst of 30,000 bhikkhus, all of whom possessed supernormal power. Right, so let's just do the math here, right? Okay, you work backwards from there. If only 1 in 100 or 1,000 can reach each of these stages, then you've got like 1 in 100 million or something can actually do it. And then now we've got 30,000 of them, so that means the entire population of Sri Lanka must have been. Anyway, there was lots. And they were good monks. That bit I'm more than willing to accept. They came to attend upon the illness of the elder Maharohanagupta at Therambattala. Imagine that. There you are, lying sick in bed, and 30,000 monks come to see you. God, what an ass. Okay. And I think we read this one before, actually. This was the one where they were attacked by the Garuda. And he went into jhana immediately to get the attack by the Garuda. So then the monks then said, now it's proper for us to perfect these as well. So the 30,000 bhikkhus heeded the elder's advice and achieved rapid response. And then it says, and helping another, right? Like Elder Rakita to do it, helping another to achieve rapid response is also difficult, and only 1 in 100 or 1,000 can do that. Okay. Now, it then comes back to what we were talking about earlier. It is only in Buddhas, Pacheka Buddhas, chief disciples, etc., who have vast previous endeavor behind them, means they're practicing their past lives, that this transformation by supernormal power and other such special qualities as the discriminations, is a Parisambhita Jnana, are brought to success simply with the attainment of arahantship and without the progressive course of development of the kind just described. Okay, so in other words, it's saying that certain individuals will just practice, and if they become an arahant, then these psychic powers will arise spontaneously. But that only happens in a few exceptional individuals who've got lots of practice in their past lives, like the Buddha and so on, and everybody else who wants to perfect them, then they have to develop the jhanas as just described. I might just have time to talk a bit more about this word. But when we're talking about the psychic powers here, the word used here is idhi. And idhi generally used to mean psychic powers, as we understand it, but also is used in ordinary everyday language to mean success or prosperous. So if a city, for example, is prosperous and wealthy, it will be called Idhi, okay? And then the commentary here in the Suttimagga then goes on to list 10 kinds of iddhi, okay, 10 kinds of success. And this is interesting because it gives us some context on the different ways that these things were seen, but also gives us some background as to what the word actually means in the Indic culture. Okay, first one, success by resolve. So when you resolve by knowledge, let me be many, or so on, so you resolve to have these psychic powers after doing the development, then this is called success by resolve. That's the first kind. Second kind, success of transformation, is when you, having abandoned his normal form, he shows himself in the form of a boy or the form of a serpent or as a manifold military array. Right? So you can show yourself as an entire army if you want to, which might have certain defense benefits, wouldn't it? I mean, you certainly cut your defense budget. You just have a few meditators to make mind-made armies. Sorry? Sorry? Yeah, well, you just hope no one calls you bluff, you know? given in this way, and then the next way, success as the mind-made body is another thought. Okay, a distinction brought about by the influence of knowledge either before the arriving of the knowledge or after it or at that moment is called both success by intervention of knowledge. And then gives a couple of examples here. Hearing. When the Venerable Bakula, as an infant, was being bathed in the stream on an auspicious day, he fell into the stream through the negligence of his nurse. Now, just to before going on with the story, you all know who Bakula was? Exactly, yeah. The monk never did. The monk was very proud of never. All the time I've been ordained, I've never so much as put a stitch in a katina cloth. I've never had any students. And I've never so much as even looked at a woman, much less, you know, anything else. And he was actually asked by a friend of his. His friend says, "Oh, how many times since you've been ordained have you had sex with a woman?" And his response was, "Well, in the 80 years since I've been ordained, I've never even had a single sensual thought, much less." And then goes on this whole kind of list of things. And he's the most extreme of the kind of Kassapa style ascetic monks. Not found anywhere in the suttas except in this one place. And he's also regarded as being the best in terms of good health. He's never had a day's sick. He never had medicine even as much as a marabellum pickled in cow's urine. Okay? He hasn't even indulged to that extent. And it's interesting because his story is only found in the Pali Canon, not found in the Agama. And a possible example of this move towards this kind of more kind of severe ascetic lifestyle. And he was obviously a controversial figure to some extent in the Ashoka Raja Sutta. He's there, and Upagupta takes Ashoka around to all the different stupas and says, "This is Ananda, and he was the great teacher," and blah blah blah. He does all these things, and he says, "Sadhu, sadhu," and he makes all these offerings, and then he takes him to Sariputta, and he's the great chief disciple, great wisdom, and so on and so forth. And he goes and makes great offerings at all of the stupas, and he takes him to Bakula's stupa and says, "This is Bakula," and he tells him about Bakula, and he says, "Oh, well, I'll give him a copper coin then." Bakula probably would have been quite happy with it. Anyway. He was supposed to be an arahant, yeah. But it's interestingly enough, his sutta, the commentary says that his sutta was added at the Second Council. Yeah. He was supposed to live very long. And the other interesting thing is he has this whole mythology behind him. Actually, the word Bakula is, etymologically, is derived from the meaning of two families. Okay? And he's given this classic mythological archetypal background story. So he's being bathed in the river on an auspicious day. So we've already got these kind of mythic things. You know, here he is being bathed in the river, the whole baptism thing. The nurse dropped him in the stream. A fish swallowed him. Right? So here we have the whole whale swallowing thing. Eventually, he came to the bathing place at Benares, and of course, the bathing place at Benares, again, being the very sacred ghats, which are been used for bathing ceremonies from time immemorial. There, the fish was caught by a fisherman and sold to a rich man's wife. The fish, she thought the fish looked good, and she wanted to cook it, so she slit it open. And when she did so, she saw the child like a golden image in the fish's stomach. Must have been a fairly large fish, that's all I can think. Oh, they do, yeah. Yeah, well, it's a whole kind of German bale thing. But the, I mean, there's still quite large fish in the Ganges. I'm quite astonished. You go on a boat there and you see these things jumping out. You think, God, they've been fishing this river for so long, and they saw some of these big fish jumping out. Anyway. She was overjoyed, thinking, at last I've got a son. So Venerable Bhakku, the safe survival in a fish's stomach in his last existence is called success by intervention of knowledge, because it was brought about by the influence of the Arahant path knowledge due to be obtained by him in this very life. Yeah? In other words, because of the fact that he was going to become an Arahant, he was protected in the fish's stomach. Right? It is, yeah. Which is officially one of the kinds of conditionality accepted in the Abhidhamma, yeah. Pachajata pachayo is the previously existing thing is conditioned by something that happens later. Yeah, that's right, yeah. Maybe by its result, but it's not necessarily by the result. There's something which... Something like that, retrospective conditionality, yeah. I mean, it makes sense in the sense of things which are lasting, yeah? Because then you know, you might build a house, right? And but one of the conditions for the building of the house is in the sense of sustaining it, right? So the condition not for its existence in the first place, but it's sustained by the repair work and maintenance which is done later on. So in that kind of sense, that makes sense. Or it could be in the sense that the previous conditioning of things, like say you build the house, again, another example, you build the Olympic Stadium. Yeah? So the building of the Olympic Stadium now is because the Olympics will happen in, you know, 4 years' time or whatever. Well, he was destined to become an Arahant, therefore he must have survived in the fish's stomach. It could be, it doesn't say that, but yeah, look, I mean, that would be the only sense in which you, you know, you could really think that he's been destined, but look, you know, theoretically, but it's more just the story has become attached to him, and then there's got to be a way of rationalizing the story.
You
know?
He's just looking.
Yeah.
Well, no, the story is probably attached to him because of his name. Bakula means two family. Bakula. Kula is family. Ba is a idiomatic form of the word. One was his original family, one was the family he was raised by. But again, that's such a stock mythic motif. Almost every hero is actually raised by a different family, and the Buddha was raised by a different mother, and almost every hero is raised by a different family. Okay. The elder, and then another story. The elder Sankicha's mother died while he was still in her womb. Right? So he's still in the womb. Mum dies. At the time of her cremation, she was pierced by stakes and placed on a pyre. The infant received a wound on the corner of his eye from the point of a stake and made a sound. Yeah. Then, thinking that the child must be alive, they took down the body and opened its belly. Which, kind of curiously enough, is not dissimilar to the previous story of the fish, isn't it? They then gave the child to the grandmother. Under her care, he grew up, and eventually he went forth and reached arahantship together with the discriminations. So Venerable Sankicha's safe survival on the pyre is called success by intervention of knowledge. So another one is the boy Bhutapala's father, who was a poor man in Rajagaha. He went into the forest with a cart to get a load of wood. It was evening when he returned to the city gate. Then his oxen slipped the yoke and escaped into the city. He seated the child beside the cart and went into the city after the oxen. Before he could come out again, the gate was closed. The child saved survival through the three watches of the night outside the city in a place infested by wild beasts and spirits is called success by the intervention of knowledge in the way just stated. Right. So this idea is there's another kind of psychic power, which is that psychic power based on that idea that you're going to become an arahant in this life, therefore you've got to survive when you're a kid. This is the idea. Okay, distinction brought about by the influence of serenity of samatha, either before the concentration or after it or at that moment, is called success by intervention of concentration. And it gives a number of examples, one example being the famous story of Sariputta sitting in the open on a moonlit night with his hair newly shaved. And then a wicked yaka, although warned by his companion, gave him a blow on the head, the noise of which was like a thunderclap. At the time the blow was given, the elder was absorbed in an attainment, so consequently he suffered no harm from the blow. This was success by intervention of the concentration in that venerable one. And of course being a very wonderful sutta from the Udana. And he talks about it with Mahamoggallana afterwards, and Moggallana saw this spirit and says to him, "Didn't you see that great yaka?" He says, "No, I didn't see anything, but I do have a slight headache." This yaka's just probably big as a mountain on his head. Okay, then another story, another well-known story is Sanjiva, was one of the chief disciples in the previous Buddha era, told him, story told in the Majjhima Nikaya that he died. Sorry, he was in the attainment of cessation. They thought he was dead and they put him in a funeral pyre, but he survived. Another story is the elder Kanu Gondanya, naturally gifted in attainment. He was sitting absorbed in attainment one night in a certain forest. 500 robbers came by with a stolen booty. Thinking that no one was following them and needing rest, they put the booty down. Thinking that he was a tree stump, they piled all the booty on top of him. The elder emerged at the predetermined time just as they were about to depart after resting at the very time, in fact, when the one who put his booty down first was picking it up. When they saw him move, they cried out in fear. The elder said, "Do not be afraid, lay followers, I am a bhikkhu." They came and paid homage. Such was their confidence in him that they went forth into homelessness and eventually they became arahants. So, not said what happened to the booty. The laywoman devotee Uttara was the daughter of a rich man called Purnaka. A harlot called Sirima, who was envious of her, poured a basin of hot oil over her head. At that moment, Uttara had attained jhana in loving-kindness. The oil ran off her like water on a lotus leaf. This was success by the intervention of concentration. So the story is told in detail in the Dhammapada commentary. And another story, King Udena's chief queen was called Samavati. The Brahmin Magandhya, who aspired to elevate his own daughter to the position of chief queen, put a poisonous snake into Samavati's lute. This is lute as in L-U-T-E, not lute as in booty, lute. Anyway. Then he told the king, "Samavati wants to kill you, sire. She is carrying a poisonous snake around in her lute." When the king found it, he was furious. Intending to kill her, he took his bow and aimed a poisoned arrow. Samavati, with her retinue, pervaded the king with loving kindness. The king stood trembling, unable either to shoot the arrow or to put it away. Then the queen said to him, "What is it, sire? Are you tired?" "Yes, I am tired." "Then put down the bow." The arrow fell at the king's feet. Then the queen advised him, "Sire, one should not hate one who has no hate." So the king's not daring to release the arrow was success by intervention of concentration in the laywoman Samavati. Again, the story told in detail in the Dhammapada commentary. Interesting that she seems to have this kind of hypnotic suggestion thing, doesn't she? Yeah. Kind of Jedi mind trick. Yeah? They're not the droids you're looking for. Okay. That which consists in. Okay, then there's another kind of sixth kind of perceiving the unrepulsive in the repulsive. This is called the Noble One Success, Arya Idhi. And so these are various perceptual transformations which one who's enlightened is able to do, which also is useful for doing it. So you can perceive something that's repulsive as unrepulsive, or you see something as that, or vice versa. So you see, you know, something which normally would make you very angry, then you can see it as something that's very loving, and so on. So you're able to transform your perception in this way. This is called the Arya Idhi, Noble One's Success. And then there's another kind of Idhi, the seventh kind of Idhi, that which consists of travelling through the air in the case of winged birds, etc., is called success born of karma result. So, so that's interesting, that the ability to fly through the air is considered to be a result of karma. As a bird does, yeah. Well, presumably it would, yeah. That which consists of travelling through the air and so on in the case of wheel-turning monarchs, etc., is called success of the meritorious. And gives various examples, and these things like a crystal palace and 64 wishing trees cleft the earth and sprang into existence for the householder Jyotika. That was the success of meritorious in his case. A golden rock of 80 cubits high was made of for Jatilaka, and Ghosi to save the right survival when attempts were made in seven places to kill him with success of the meritorious, and the appearance to Mandaka of Rams, which is Mandaka, made of the seven gems in a place the size of one sita, one half of a plow, was success of the meritorious in Mandaka. So this is this idea that through performance of various meritorious acts that you can experience magical results for that karma, not just in future lives or anything, but that will manifest immediately. When Mendika washed his head and looked up at the sky, 12,500 measures were filled for him with red rice from the sky. When his wife took up a nali measure of cooked rice, the food was not used up, even though she served the whole of Jungledeepa with it. So this being, of course, comparable to the story of the loaves and fishes. When his son took a purse containing 1,000 coins, the coins were not exhausted, even though he made gifts to all the inhabitants of Jumbudipa. When his daughter-in-law took a pint measure of paddy, the grain was not used up, even when she shared it among all the inhabitants of Jumbudipa, of course, Jumbudipa being India. And when the slave ploughed with a single ploughshare, there were 14 furrows, 7 on each side. This was the success of the meritorious in them. So in other words, this idea that there are these various meritorious beings and so they get these quite extraordinary results. Maybe these days it's, I don't know, winning the lottery or something like that. But these also bear comparison with the very common mythic idea of the cornucopia or the horn of plenty. Then there is the another interesting one. The ninth one is the success through the sciences, and here he's translating sciences is vidya, Pali V-I-J-J-A, and of course being the same meaning as the English wicca, W-I-C-C-A, it's being the same word with the same meaning. And so, what is the success through the sciences or through the esoteric arts? Perhaps we might say the masters of the esoteric arts, having pronounced their scientific spells, their vidya, travel through the air, and they show an elephant in space or in the sky, and they show a manifold military array. So this again being acknowledgement that you don't have to have jhanas to be able to do these things. And then the 10th one is the succeeding of such and such work through such and such right exertion. Okay, in the sense that abandoning lust happens through renunciation and making an effort at that, abandoning defilement through the path of arahantship, and so on. So the fact that you can, basically the idea that you can learning a trade like making a cart or learning medicine or studying the Vedas or anything like that, any work connected with ploughing and so on, the distinction pursued by doing such work is success in the sense of succeeding due to right exertion applied appropriately. So that's obviously more or less success in just the ordinary everyday sense that we take it, yeah? And you do the work and then you get the results from it. So these are the 10 kinds of success, or 10 kinds of idhi, which are mentioned here as a precursor to the discussion of the idhi in the Samanya Pala Sutta. So, there you go. So next week we'll start with the idhis themselves, and then the rest of the Chalabhinna. Any more questions? Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, definitely. And CGI, yeah. Special effects.
Yeah.
Yeah. How's it work? Does it work?
Yeah,
I don't know. Do you think it works?
I wonder how it works. Before we talk about it, I think my bank account, I can transfer it. I think, I'm certainly in the tradition that I was before, but
it only works if the subject can see it on the ritual, otherwise it doesn't. But if you love by the way, it's good enough for the ritual and the gods.
Yeah, I mean the basic thing to always bear in mind is that the most fundamental teaching the Buddha made is that we're the owners of our karma. So nobody else can own our karma. And the good deeds that we do stay with us. But of course we can still influence each other. So I can do a good deed and I can't give that good deed to you or to anybody else, but I can influence you and encourage you also. Or, you know, so somebody may have mudita or rejoice in that, which of course is what anamodana is rejoicing along with the good deeds of others. And by the intention of sharing them in that way also is itself a good deed. Yeah? So the person who does the good deeds themselves, they have good karma from doing it. They also have a good karma from sharing it, which sort of amplifies it. So the sharing it, it's not like a bank account in that sense, because it's not like yours becomes less because you've transferred it to somebody else. Yeah, but that you actually make more good karma by then encouraging others in that good. Yeah, but of course the reality is, and just sticking to what we can observe, is that you can do all the good deeds in your life and encourage others to do good deeds in your life, and sometimes that will work and sometimes it won't. Right? And there's some people who you can do all the good deeds that you want and they'll just completely ignore it. It doesn't make any difference to them. So in the case of where they say sharing merits and these kinds of things, and the way that this is explained is that in many realms that you're reborn into, that there's no possibility of sharing merits. Okay, and so for example, if you're in the hell realms and you're sitting there boiling in a pot of lead, and somebody offers you some food, and you say, excuse me, good warden of hell, do you think you might just let me out of this hot boiling bed so I can go off and have a nice meal? And I'll say, shut up. And if you're born into the animal realm, then, well, you're just an animal, and you're kind of eating what you eat and doing what you do, and it doesn't really have any effect on you. If you're born in the heaven realms, then you wouldn't want to eat any of that disgusting crap in the human realm anyway, right? So you've got your own divine food and everything, so that's pretty irrelevant. And if you're in the Asura realm, then you've just got to take what you want anyway, so it doesn't really matter. But there are apparently certain hungry ghost realms, certain kinds of hungry ghosts, who in a sense are very, it's a very kind of dependent, very needy relationship. And they have a sense of a great sense of kind of loss and being, a sense of that being ignored and being forgotten. And so when food is offered on their behalf and merits are offered on their behalf, then they rejoice in that. They feel somebody's remembered them. They feel loved. They feel cared for. And so because of that, and because of their rejoicing in that good deeds of others, that can constitute their own good karma. And so that's the only kind of karma that they can make in that realm, because the mind is so constricted. So if you do that and do that offering, then they can rejoice in that, and then they can obtain the rebirth of karma.
But they only have to merit if they rejoice.
That's right. Actually, they have to respond to it. Exactly the same as in the human realm, yeah? You can do all the encouragement for others to do good, but unless they respond to it, then it doesn't accomplish anything. So it's not just purely a transfer.
Is there any
economical
benefits from what you said about
hungry ghosts? I don't remember
now. Where is it? Well, I can't remember what social benefits maybe. But the person asked what happens, but I don't see relevance.
You've got so many relatives, you must have some in that realm, yeah. There is something that's said in the sutras, I can't remember exactly what's on that point, what exactly is said and what isn't said, but we should look it up again, find the sutra. I can't remember.
Well, that's in the Pesach.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Let's finish with paying respects.
Bhagavato